morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of March. It's All Things Political this hour. Our guest is Professor David Siegel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Florida State University. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Siegel. Here's our phone number. So much to talk about. Foreign affairs, possibility of Jeb Bush running for president. And here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Siegel, nice to have you on again. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay.
Good. Let's start with the defense secretary in Afghanistan, because this just seems to be getting messier and messier. There was a bomb that went off in Kabul. And then we've got Ahmad Karzai accusing the U.S. of collusion with the Taliban to convince Afghans that violence will get worse if foreign troops leave that area. What a mess, huh?
Yeah, that's a pretty good it's a pretty good way of characterizing the situation, yes. Mess is pretty accurate.
So how do we move forward in that country? What about this tension? And it seems to be growing. It's always been there between the U.S. and Karzai.
Well, so Karzai has to play to not only, we sort of interpret everything as, in relation to us, but, Karzai has to play to his own constituency and the people keeping him in power. So a lot of that, you never know how much of that is actually not related to us at all, but really just a whole bunch of trying to make sure he can stay in power, right? Make sure, and a good way to stay in power is to, create a common enemy and have everyone be happy with that person or
right.
The country, so.
And who is it who's keeping him in power?
We tend to think of, sort of democratic coalitions, right? But in a country like that, nominally, there's an electorate, but there's also, a coterie of, warlords and sort of other people who are, supporters, who, mobilize people to vote for him, who give him resources, who, that kind of thing. He has to make sure they're all happy too, and he has to make sure that they're not unhappy with his inability to do much of anything in response to the Taliban. Right, so if the Taliban start upping their attacks when we leave, right, he's going to get a lot of blowback if people die. But if he can blame it on someone else, then he's hopefully, in his mind, trying to reduce the degree to which he's responsible.
Does the new defense secretary have a different set of thoughts than the previous defense secretary about how to proceed in Afghanistan?
Better, no. It's always easy to have thoughts before you start the job. But if you look at, if you look at the president, right? The president during his campaigns was different than the president who, was in office in terms of foreign policy. I think it's difficult to maintain your pre-existing beliefs about these things when you're actually, there. I'm dealing with the stuff on the ground. So I'm not actually sure if he'll maintain his beliefs. In the past he had different beliefs. But again, A, he's supposed to, in theory, be supporting the president's beliefs here as a member of the cabinet, and B, been presented with different circumstances on the ground. It's unclear if he'll maintain his different beliefs. So I think that's pretty much anyone's guess.
Do you think that we've made progress in that country?
In which sort of dimension?
I don't know, in every dimension. having people be able to take over for themselves and lessening the amount of terror?
I think certainly progress, yes. Some progress. It's a really difficult situation. We're talking about a fairly large land area, relatively sparsely populated in parts, very mountainous, and there's a lot of evidence that says just the sheer terrain makes it really difficult for anyone to stop counter government actions like insurgencies or terrorism and stuff. So that alone makes it difficult to act. However, despite that, if you look at certain metrics, right? So before we entered, there was it was a Taliban-y effective authoritarian government. Now there's these some measures of democracy. At least, more importantly to me, I think that there's at least some impression among the citizenry that they should have say over their own own futures. So that's the kind of thing that I think can build on itself if it's allowed to. And there are, we did train lots of people. But it's difficult. I mean, that's a difficult region to keep control of as a whole. It's unclear that really any amount of local forces can keep control of it completely, keep the Taliban out. I mean, the Taliban succeeded primarily because they just were brutal. I mean, they're absolutely brutal, and that enabled them to succeed. I mean, we don't want that level of success from local forces.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unclear that, acting in sort of the rule of law, if we could trust them to do that, acting in the rule of law would actually enable them to maintain control of the whole country. So I think it's an open question. I don't know of anyone who knows, if things are going to go well there. I think we have made progress, and there's been a lot of, effort and, very good and brave and smart people going into that, trying to make that work. And given the circumstances, I think they've done a pretty good job. It just, can it be done, the kind of job we would expect, in the U.S.? I don't know.
Let's go to Rome for a moment. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this unless the audience does, but it's really striking to me that you have every major news network broadcasting from Rome. They started over the weekend or even started last week. Does the election of a new pope have any impact on world politics at all, and why is it such a huge news event?
I think it has an effect in different regions of the world. I mean, in the U.S., I'm not sure it has much of an effect. I mean, U.S. public opinion of Catholics tend to diverge pretty substantially from Rome. But, Latin America and Africa, I mean, these are areas with, there's like over a billion Catholics, right? And not all of them are as divergent from Roman opinion as the U.S. Catholic population is. So I think it does have an effect. I think the Pope can have a fairly substantial policy effect in certain regions of the world. And also even in the U.S., you can think of things like how the new Pope will treat, the constant barrage of, issues with, now cardinals, but also, local bishops, priests, right? So that horrible mess. I mean, how the Pope treats that can affect local politics as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has an effect. I don't know if it has an effect justifying, wall-to-wall coverage for a weekend, but, it's entertaining to watch the white smoke come up and everything.
It's almost like another election, isn't it, that we're just
exactly
waiting for another election, and so who are the factions, and waiting for the smoke. There's an element of drama about the whole thing.
Oh, certainly. And you can, and there are, the same way as the election, there are, who's going to be the next pope? You can vote on it. There are aggregator sites that can give you probabilities. So it has the same sort of, the same sort of entertainment value as an election has in that sense.
The other person who was all over television yesterday was the gentleman from your state, Jeb Bush, former governor, who appears to be interested in 2016, wouldn't you say?
Quite possibly, yes. I mean, he always had been, I think. After George W.'s tenure, I think he had to pretty much vanish for a while. But yeah, I think it's certainly something he's interested in. I mean, as far as you can tell from, on the outside, right? But then, there's a lot of people. This is the time when the candidates across the spectrum of, are sort of jockeying to get positioned to start the invisible primary. People call it, right? The primary, but the local party officials and then across the country start to move towards picking their candidate before they start trying to sell it to the population at large. So this is the time when you have, Jeb Bush and Rubio and Rand Paul and all those potential, Bobby Jindal and all those potential candidates jockeying for position and trying to, jump out of the pack as the person that the party leadership should focus on and put their money in. And just really push.
Don't you think it's a bit much to do all this so far away from 2016?
I mean, from my perspective, yeah. I'm not ready to say, I don't think most people are ready to start paying attention to themselves. But it takes a long time to build this, party edifice up. Right? So the party has to choose you, and that can take a while. And then once the party chooses you, it has to start has to start going around and trying to solicit resources from party donors, has to start getting people in the local party machinery on board. That takes time. And given the recent, you know, we constantly move backward and generally start the election process as is, so, you know, it might take a couple of years to get the stuff going, at which point we're moving into the, you know, the general election, the primary election season, which isn't that much later than the, you know, midterms at this rate, midterm elections. So if it takes a couple of years to get the stuff moving, starting now isn't that out of the realm of ridiculousness, even if the people at large don't really want to hear about it yet.
Right. Do you see, Professor Siegel, any indications that the Republican Party is, because they have to, wooing new voters, and if so, who those voters may be, and how are they wooing them?
Well, I think there's going to be a strong push towards wooing the Latino voters, and you can see that with the move in immigration reform. So, I mean, several people had been in the past pro immigration reform. You had like John McCain and those people were actually, you know, pushing it. And then when the mood turned away from it, it sort of vanished as a, you know, and then in the last election campaign, everyone was talking about, oh, well, you supported the DREAM Act. You must be a horrible human being, right? And I think this what they gathered from that response from the actual vote outcome was that was a really bad strategy given demographic shifts in this country. So I think what's happening is you're seeing a lot more attention paid towards maybe making some reform in that area. You have people willing to go across the aisle. You have new proposals being made by Republicans trying to create some path to citizenship. But it's a difficult road because they're trying to then capture different constituencies that have different preferences within their electorate, within their supporters. You know, not everyone of the supporters wants to have, you know, a path towards citizenship. So you have to be a little careful. And this is a problem that Democrats have had for years, is trying to balance these very different constituencies. And so for Democrats, you have, you know, the constituency that you know, wants to maintain jobs, but the constituency that you know, has environmental reform as an interest, right? And they have different preferences often at the local level. This is the same kind of thing here, where you have Republicans who might want immigration reform. You know, maybe some more socially conservative Latino voters would be supportive, you know, if you could address some of their issues, and immigration reform is seen as being sort of their issue, right or wrong. By the same token, you have supporters of the Republican Party who don't want any path to citizenship, and, you know, for illegal immigrants, and that creates tension within the party. So it'll be interesting to see how they manage that over the next couple of years. But it's definitely moving that direction.
And what about Jeb Bush? Does he have a clear position now in immigration reform?
That I'm afraid I'm not really sure, but I haven't been keeping up on Jeb's positions. He's been sort of out of the spotlight recently. So I'm actually not sure if he has. My recollection was that he was more on the pro-reform thing, but I think he'll follow along with some of the immigration reforms that are coming up now. I don't recall his being heavily, you know, ideologically opposed as opposed to, you know, practically at any time. I mean, I think one of the reasons he did better in Florida was that he actually was less ideologically opposed in general. I think he's coming up with his own plans now that are probably in sync. And I'm just looking at now, and it looks like, yeah, he claims he's in sync with the general Republican strategy.
I know that he received some criticism because he seemed to have contradictory comments on immigration reform last week.
Yeah, so I see he was claiming that he's actually in sync, and that's not actually he not actually differs. I mean, at this point in time, any candidate who's trying to separate themselves from the pack is going to have to simultaneously be supportive of his or her party's plat, you know, goals and present actions, but also come up with something new and different and exciting. Otherwise, it looks pretty bad. So you probably see a lot of this sort of statements made and then statements backed up and new statements made over the next, you know, year or so.
We are going to welcome phone calls. We have yet to talk about the sequester. We'll talk more about that and if we're seeing any major impact on the U.S. economy in terms of people being laid off from their jobs, military cuts. Have those gone into effect? Are there other cuts that have influenced our economy, hurt the economy in some way? And Obamacare is in the news again with Paul Ryan saying we'll repeal Obamacare. We welcome your phone calls. Gun ownership. It was an interesting story in the New York Times. Was it Sunday or Saturday? Showing that gun ownership is way down in this country, which was surprising to me. I don't know about to you. We can talk about that as well. At any rate, here is how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, should you want to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, the Barlow Planetarium in Menasha is celebrating its 15th anniversary. They've invited Phil Plate, astronomer, lecturer, author, and creator of Bad Astronomy, to give a series of lectures. He'll be joining us along with Alan Pesch, who's director of the Barlow Planetarium. We'll also talk about all the latest happenings in space. All right, for you to be a part of all things political, 800-486-8655 is our number. Our guest is Professor David Siegel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Florida State University. And we start our calls with Dave in Menominee. Hi, Dave. Dave, are you there? I think Dave walked away. We'll give him one more second. Dave. Call us back, Dave. Sorry, you got to stay by your phone. I think that he wanted to talk about Paul Ryan, and let's talk a little bit about Paul Ryan, who did say that they were going to repeal Obamacare. Is that conversation still going to continue, a possible repeal of this health care reform, which is supposed to go into full effect next year?
There have been a ridiculous large number of votes about repealing Obamacare over the course of, particularly in the House, over the course of the last couple of years. I feel at one point it was 33 votes, all having the same outcome, which is, you know, didn't work. I think this is a sort of a red meat type of position, right? So you can say I want to repeal Obamacare, and that plays to a certain segment of your voters. I don't think that's at this point hugely likely after the Supreme Court decision, after the numerous votes that failed. The fact is, a lot of the provisions of Obamacare are actually fairly favorably viewed by most of the population. I mean, the actual name Obamacare might not be, but the actual provisions in the law are actually viewed fairly favorably. So it would be fairly difficult to, at this point, to actually repeal it when people start actually benefiting from, you know, for instance, you and your kids can be on your and your medical care, pre-existing conditions get covered, and this is the kind of thing that people are going to like. It's the same reason it's so hard to do anything at all with Medicare. I mean, these are Social Security. These are government policies that are actually viewed fairly favorably across a large segment of the population. And whether or not you believe they shouldn't be in existence doesn't change the fact that if 75 to 80% of the population want them, you're going to have a really hard time convincing even a bunch of ideologically motivated Congress people or senators to vote to repeal them against their own constituency's desires.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I'd be really surprised. I mean, it's possible, certainly, but I'd be really surprised if they had significant traction beyond maybe, you know, attacking the edges and the margins.
Let's go to Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael. Where is everybody today? Michael, are you there? All right, Dave in Menominee. Hi, Dave.
See, it's going dead.
What?
Hello?
Yeah, we're here, Dave. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, we've got a problem with our phones. I'm sorry. That's what's going on here. So we'll just keep talking. I don't know what the problem is. We'll put you on hold here for a second, Dave, and we may be able to get a hold of you. And we were talking about health care. Let's look at the whole issue of sequester at this point. and whether or not it has had a substantial impact, and if you worry that it will have, or you're not very worried about the effects that the sequester will have. Are we seeing effects now?
I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of effects now, but I think there'll be soon. I mean, sequester in general is not a good idea. the intent was never to actually have it, happen. It just was a miscalculation on the part of president in terms of where the Republican Party is going to move in terms of debt reduction versus military cuts. And the best I can sort of analogize it to is, it's like saying you have to cut 10% out of your household budget, but instead of deciding where the 10% should be cut, you decide to just cut it across the board, including food and housing, and you end up on the street with no food, right? Whereas you could have just cut 10%, say, from your entertainment budget. It's just not a good idea to have these undirected cuts across the board without any real ability to direct them. And I think they recognize this, and there's some movement towards trying to ameliorate certain of the cuts. The thing is, I think that the cuts are going to be felt most, relatively soon, is among the poorer people in the society who most need the things that have been cut. The relatively small bore government policies that provide sort of immediate help, and that's going to be a problem, I think. And you've seen so far in the economy that, despite the fact that there's been really high unemployment, you haven't seen a lot of loss of corporate profits because of gains in productivity and cost-cutting. And I don't think, in terms of the economy as measured by companies, it's going to have much of an effect on sequester. I mean, there is some effect on military production, but again, there are some requirements that I think the sequester doesn't affect certain areas, so that'll probably mostly affect it on systems production. So I think, in general, that's not right now. And again, the sequester is a staged thing. It's not all hitting right now. I think that won't have a tremendous effect, or at least that effect can be managed. And I don't think it'll be a huge effect. I don't think the Dow will collapse or anything like that. I do think that's going to hurt the people who are just sort of scrambling to now maybe have a shot at getting back into the game, getting jobs again. And I think that's going to hurt them most of all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's just not directed. And I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that this is really not the time to be worrying too much about the debt at this particular moment in time, given historical trends and debt as a function of GDP and all that.
The president was meeting, wining and dining members of Congress, and was quite the word that was used repeatedly, charming, over the weekend. And does that mean that maybe they'll get rid of the sequester for now, or work on some kind of deal, or not?
I mean, I'd hope they work on a deal. That would be ideal. I mean, at this point, though, there's so much, right now. I mean, my impression is part of that's to manage just the inability to do anything. The president's had a very difficult time to have any of his policies go forward, and they just get stopped before they even have votes. I think this is part of a sort of charm offensive to get, maybe limited number of filibusters against, judicial appointments or cabinet appointments, to maybe have some of these policies proposing go through to a vote. I think that's the attempt, at least, because at the moment there's very much a sort of us versus them attitude going on, and where votes are party line. There's a lot of polarization, in the House, a little less in the Senate, but still quite a bit. And it's difficult to get anything done at all at that point. The Senate, with the filibuster, you effectively need a supermajority to do much of anything, and that's difficult to make. And the House, with the rules as they are, if the party in power of the Senate, the House decides not to put anything up for a vote, you have a hard time making anything go on there. Now, a few things have gone through despite that, and Boehner's been able to, Boehner's been willing to at times to put things up for a vote, despite the fact that his own party doesn't support it, the majority of his party, but that hasn't been that frequent. So I think this sort of charm offensive is designed to maybe move around the leadership of the parties in the hopes that maybe the rank and file is more willing to bargain, and then if they can put pressure on the leadership not to stop all these things from going through to a vote, then maybe some of the stuff can actually happen, including the sequester. But I think more widely, just a an array of policies that the administration wants to at least, you know, put forward, but just has gotten no traction whatsoever on.
There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of concern, though, that the government is going to shut down at the end of this month. Is there? Why are they not allowing that to happen?
I think both parties recognize that's a bad idea at this point in time. I think both parties have come to the conclusion that they wouldn't benefit politically from shutting down the government, so therefore it's not worth fighting over that particular action. I mean, it strikes me that the Democrats don't want that at all. The Republicans would prefer to fight on different fronts. They didn't win the previous shutdowns in terms of the political response of the electorate, so I would imagine that they decide this is not a good place to fight at the moment, given the really historically low approval rating of Congress as a whole.
Right. Well, you've got a problem, and you've got such philosophical differences, right, that it's hard to have any compromise on this particular issue. How do you do it?
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult when all the responses are ideological driven and not actually driven off of, you know, any kind of, I don't know, any kind of concrete, you know, real world considerations here. I mean, it's very difficult to actually come up with consensus, or even not consensus, just some kind of compromise, when compromise itself is viewed as a negative. The way candidates have lately taken to selling themselves has been I fight for you, I fight for this. I put forth a very, you know, explicit, you know, strong statement about what I believe in, and I fight for that, and I'm not going to cave in, and I'm not going to give up, and, you know, I'll be your, you know. So it's all very couched in the language of sort of war and fighting and, you know, aggression, and we're going to take on the opponent, we're going to make this work. It's difficult when you have that kind of sales pitch to then go back and say, oh, well, you know, well, I cut a deal on this. Because cutting a deal now has this connotation of giving in, of capitulating. And in general, and the view is that's going to make you look weak and you're not going to win the election. Plus, you add to that the worry of being primaried for the Republicans. There's a constant threat of having a primary candidate run against you from the right. And that's been successful enough times that now it's a real concern, you know, across the board.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be careful that you don't, you know, offend any backers who are willing to fund, you know, a more right-wing candidate and then, you know, take you out of the thing completely before you even get to the election. So it's just really difficult to come up with a way in which it's going to work. I mean, what you need is you need members who are either in sort of more moderate districts who can afford to potentially act differently or cut deals, or you need really entrenched senators or congresspeople who have reasonably safe districts,
mm-hmm.
who are willing to go out on the limb and compromise. But that's difficult, you know, to find those people willing to do that. I mean, you know, Boehner's done that at times by actually letting certain things pass, you know, which have not been popular in all quarters. But, you know, McConnell's done that as well occasionally when it served his purposes, right? So this is, you occasionally see this, but it's difficult given the present climate to get any kind of compromise.
Yeah, you rarely see it. Let's try another phone call. We're having problems getting people to hear us, but let's try this and see. Our number is 800-486-8655. So bear with us, Rocky. We'll experiment here and push some other buttons. Can you hear me, Rocky?
Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, he can't hear me, though.
Hello?
Okay, Rocky, hello?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have no idea what's going on. I can hear everybody just fine. Maybe people just need to talk. If you're listening on the radio, can you hear me now, Rocky?
I can hear you now.
Hey, Rocky, hello?
I got the radio on.
Turn it down, please. Okay, Rocky. No, it's not working. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everybody. We want to take as many calls as we can, but we're just having problems here. So that's the way it goes. When it comes to the now being a bad time to be doing a sequester and to be spending all our time focusing on the deficit, I have to ask you, Professor Siegel, why are we still doing that? Why is there no room to look at whether or not deficit reduction needs to be our primary goal right now?
think it's mostly political. I think some people believe that this is a winning political strategy, that of the various issues that they could be highlighting, this is the one that best serves their purposes, and they're trying to sell that. Right? I mean, it's a relatively easy argument to make. Right? You make the argument that, oh, well, you wouldn't run your household in massive debt, even though we all do with houses, right? But you wouldn't run your household in massive debt, and we shouldn't run our country in massive debt, and, you know, it's a clear, easy sort of argument to make. And get people on board, and you argue that the government's irresponsible, and that fits in with your ideology, and that allows you. That's a position that sells well. So I think it's a way to get people on your side in that particular argument. I mean, it's really no different than past years, right? At various times in history, different arguments sell well, and those are the ones that get pushed. You know, at one time, gay marriage was a relatively big issue just a few years ago, right? And that was sort of viewed as a wedge issue. With the population's movement away from sort of opposition there, you know, that's died off a lot. It's not, you know, now you have people coming up and saying they're for it. You know, it's a conservative position, right?
Mm-hmm.
These change a lot just because if the population's views change or if different issues pop up as being winning issues or at least being perceived as winning issues for the party, then they'll focus on those issues and really try to play them up. So, you know, and that's true for both parties. I mean, both parties try to identify the issues that are going to be winners for them, and they really push those issues. I think you saw immigration. The Democrats seized that one, and I think it's been really good for them. And they've viewed it as a good issue for them, given demographic shifts in the country, and they've pushed that. Now the Republicans are trying to play catch up on that and try to show that they're not just uniformly against any kind of immigration reform. I think sequester sequester and budget cutting is the same kind of thing. I mean, I think the Republicans have always ideologically been supportive of cutting the budget, and this fits really nicely. I think they found a way to frame it that gets a lot of support. I think that fits nicely into their own ideology, so I think that's an issue they could push. And they have a lot of people in the party who believe it deeply and strongly, you know, for that. They have the libertarian streak, and then they want the government to be much smaller. And I think that because they have those people in the party, they can sort of use them to sort of sell the message in a good way. I don't know if the entire Republican Party, and I don't think they are uniformly for just massive across the board cuts. But I think enough believe that the public will be okay with that, that they're willing to go forward with this.
Yeah, we. Are having all things political discussion this hour, and our guest is Professor David Siegel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Florida State University. We, for some bizarre reason, are having a hard time taking phone calls, so I'm just going to, if you would like to enter our conversation and can use our email, that would be probably the way to go, at least until we try to solve this problem. I don't know if it's solved or not. We'll try again. But if you want to make sure your comment gets heard, send an email to us, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We think we have the phone problem fixed. Hooray! Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. All of you have been trying to get through. I think you can now, so call. Let's go to Chris in Columbus. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question statement for your guest here. Now, I was a history major my first trip through college, and just basic historical economics. No country has ever survived a debt-to-GDP ratio over 100%, and we will reach that in a few short years. So it's just basic economics that we absolutely have to reduce our spending in order to keep this wonderful experiment in democracy going.
So I'm not sure can you tell me where you get that number from over 100%? Because what I've been reading is that it's actually declining now. We're down to, I think, 89%. And a lot of that's actually due to a recession, which should decline further than that.
which is why we need to keep reducing. I mean, historically, our debt to GDP ratio is between 30% and 35%, and that is where it was when we were actually excelling as a country, between 55% and 70%.
We took on massive debt after World War II, and that was the primary explosion in sort of the GI Bill and all that stuff like that. That had a huge effect, huge positive effect on our economic growth after World War II, which really really boomed. I'm not at all trying to advocate for a huge debt. It's the question more is cutting at this particular point in time the best way to achieve a lower debt. Because debt's not only a function of spending; it's also a function of intake. And if you don't address both issues, then you really tie your hands in terms of what you can do to minimize the debt. I mean, if, for instance, and this is just a purely hypothetical situation, right? You know, if you had two options, one of which cut the debt by 100 billion by pure cuts, but one of which cut by 30 billion, but added 20 billion revenue due to a combination of, revenue increases and also just improvements in the economy. I mean, wouldn't you choose the second one?
I don't know. Yeah. I would flatten the tax code and make everybody a player. Right now, 40% of people don't pay income tax, so they don't actually have an educated interest in tax policy.
But it's difficult to understand how you would actually, if you wanted to flatten the tax code for those 40% and have them pay in, you would also have to, unless you're just willing to, these are people who don't necessarily have, tons of money to pay the taxes. You'd also have to then add on government outlays to these people. And I think that's not, a lot of economic perspectives tend to prefer not biasing people's decisions by, differential rules. So if you flatten the tax code, I think there would be support for adding on additional government outlays for these same 40%. That has some benefits, but also it doesn't end the problem of having money in and out. Right?
Thanks very much for the call, Chris. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our phones are finally working. Rocky is next. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Well, good. I can hear you now.
Good. Yeah, we could always hear you. Some switch in another room, so it's fixed.
Okay. So anyhow, I was just wondering. Let's get back to the subject of the household budget. No, if I had a household and I was in debt up to my butt, do you think it'd be a wise idea to keep spending? And how many creditors do you think would allow me to keep spending and buying things that I don't need? Do you think they'd allow me to buy my own medical insurance and things like that? I'm just kind of curious.
That's a fair point. The issue, though, is that the analogy to a household is not really appropriate. In a house, right? So debt to a house from a household is debt out of the household, right? You owe someone else. You owe creditors things. In our case, a lot of the debt we owe is to ourselves, right? Individuals in the country, have bonds, government bonds. That's a debt. That's a government debt that we actually own, right? And further, a lot of the issues with increasing revenue involve spending money, right? Spending money within the country, out of the country, increasing exports. These are ways we can, increase the GDP and therefore decrease the overall debt ratio in a way a household can't do, right? If, for instance, your household could, increase debt by, say, increasing income at a faster rate, you might be for the debt, right? So that's how businesses work. If you take out a loan, right, the presumption is you're going to use the loan money and obtain a better rate of return on the money they loan you than the interest rate you're paying to the bank, right? At that point, you want the loan because it helps you grow as a business. These type of considerations are present in the government in a way that's not really present in household finances. I'm all for not having massive debt. However, if you could take out a loan and get back twice as much from that loan than you gave, and if that was more than the overall interest payments, then you would do that, right?
Thanks very much, Rocky, for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. When you talk, Professor Siegel, about money coming in as well, the controversy, of course, also continues about tax rates in this country. John Boehner was saying a week and a half ago or so that the president got his increase on upper-income earners in January, and that's it. Is more needed? Can you explain why the president would go the route of asking for more, and from whom is he asking how much?
I think he's only asking for for sort of reductions in loopholes, which have the effect of raising the effective tax rate on the upper percentages of the tax base. There's a larger worry that comes up a lot in sort of political science and economic circles, which is the idea of inequality. And that, I think, is an ideological difference, which sort of is across the spectrum, but it doesn't have to be, because there's actually a fairly good bit of evidence that shows that inequality as a whole is just bad for the government, it's bad for the country, it's bad for growth, it's bad for economic growth to have too much inequality in a country. And the times in which we've actually had the best economic growth have been times of less inequality. In fact, you can map it out, and economic growth tracks pretty well with a decrease in inequality, economic inequality. And the problem is now we have one of the most unequal societies in terms of where the money is that we've had in a long time. And I think that's part of the impetus, political impetus, for a movement on the tax code.
Let's go next to Joan in Madison. Hi, Joan.
I'm Joan from Milwaukee.
All right, Joan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, my question is, since the taxpayer has to pay so many billions of dollars that come in to pay on the deficit and the debt, why does he suggest that it's not important to lower both?
Oh, so I don't mean to say that it's not important to lower them, and obviously, all else equal, you would want to lower it as much as possible. The question is, does the money you're paying out in the debt, is it exceeded by the benefit you get from having a debt, right? I mean, it's no different than a home mortgage in that sense. You're willing to take out a mortgage on a house because the benefit you perceive to get from the house exceeds the outlay you're putting on you're paying to the bank. Even though you're paying to the bank debt service at a fairly bad rate, right? Because most of mortgage payments are front loaded, so you're paying most of the insurance at first. I mean, most of the interest at first. You're getting a benefit from the house, and you're also comparing the benefit you get from the house to the outlay you would get from, say, renting. I mean, it's all about the comparison. It's not in absolute terms. So all I'm trying to argue is that if we believe, and that's an item you can disagree with, if you believe, though, that the benefit you're getting from the debt at a given time exceeds the cost you're paying for it, then it's worthwhile to keep the debt at that point in time, which is better. So the original sort of view of this kind of thing that supports spending now is that you pay down the debt when you have lots of money, right? And you don't pay down the debt when you don't have lots of money, and you use the money instead to spur the economy now so the economy grows and you get more revenue, and then use that revenue later when the economy picks up and starts going by itself, better to pay down the debt then. That's all I'm trying to argue here. Debt in itself, I agree, is not ideal. It's just if you can use the debt money to do something better with it in terms of overall revenue, then it might make sense to have it.
Let's go to John in Somerset. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my phone call. I just want to say if these people in Washington and representatives can't take care of this problem with the sequester, is that it will be taken out of our hands, and then we'll be like Greece, and we'll have austerity measures put in place. So then that's how they take care of it.
Is that a
question? Thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. You want to respond to that, John? Or do you want to respond to that, David?
Oh, sorry, I'm unclear if it's supposed to be a good thing or bad. I mean, Greece is not doing well. so far, the austerity measures in Europe have not been spectacularly positive in terms of improving their economies or decreasing their debt ratio in many cases. So I'm not entirely sure if that comment was viewed as a positive or negative.
Is there any way our economy is still kind of sluggish here? There are people who unemployment rate is down a bit, but indications are that people are not keeping up with the cost of living, that that we're seeing more and more inequality. Is there a way to increase the number of good paying jobs in this country if you're dealing with paying down a debt? Can you do both at the same time? What would it take to keep the economy from growing even more sluggish?
That's a sort of multiple part question. I mean, so there's two issues there. One, how you view the economy. Do you view the economy as sort of the overall functioning of the market and, you know, corporations? In which case, the economy is actually doing pretty well comparatively at the moment. I mean, I think the Dow just closed at record highs. If you view the economy as employment, that's a really difficult issue. That's going to be difficult long-term for numerous reasons. I mean, one is a lot of productivity gains. I mean, productivity gains now and going forward have not necessarily been in ways that support larger employment, right? I mean, if you can, I mean, this has been a problem and has come up repeatedly in the past, you know, few decades, right? When you automate production, that takes away jobs from individuals. Now you move them to fewer jobs that are higher skilled, you know, to manage the automation, but it still takes away overall jobs and requires more education for the jobs that it has. And that I see as continuing. I mean, that kind of process, as technology improves, that process will continue. And that's going to make it difficult to maintain this sort of job engine growth, and unclear to me how we're going to keep that up. I mean, a lot of jobs moved to service over the past, you know, bunch of decades. Can that continue? You know, that's an open question, I think. In terms of debt, I mean, debt is certainly an issue and it's a problem, and ideally we would, you know, pare that down. You know, and frankly, we should have pared that down when we had the surplus, you know, a decade ago. Mm-hmm. That's the perfect time to actually cut down the debt and not pay it then. But as a bigger issue is just the growth in healthcare expenditures. And that's an enormous issue. And that's a really difficult political issue to take. Whereas, you know, people are generally supporting, you know, you can tell by the callers, paring down the debt.
Right.
People generally don't support cutting down on healthcare payments. But that's, you know, that's, Social Security is relatively okay compared to that, but Medicare is a, you know, a big problem going to happen. And it's unclear if, you know, Obamacare or anything else we're doing now has going to have any real positive effect long-term on that problem. It's supposed to be dealt with, sort of a time bomb there.
Yeah.
And that's going to be, I think, a big drag on the economy.
Mike in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. I'll be real quick. The reference to the amount of debt that we're carrying, I think, and the number of countries that have failed with high debt, I would just have to say that most of those countries were overextended militaristically. The British, the Japanese during the early 1900s, I could go on and on about that, but we have 800 to 1,000 military bases around the globe, and we just can't afford it anymore. If we continue this empire, the American empire, we'll continue to go broke. We need to really turn our attention to Medicare and taking care of homeless and so on and so forth. So I'd like to hear your response.
Thanks. So there again, I think it's a question of, I mean, I think you're right about overextension. So the question is, you know, what can we afford, given our, you know, overall economic growth? How much can we afford? How much can't we afford? And what do we need? And what do we need to spend to do what we need to do? I think we have to be careful not just, you know, doing a blanket withdrawal, because we do have, you know, various interests across the world, and we do, you know, as sort of a more normative, you know, moral issue, want to support, you know, freedoms and democracy as much as possible when we can. You know, so for instance, the Korean, we haven't talked about Korea at all yet, but I mean that issue, you know, we basically, you know, decades ago promised South Korea that we would, you know, protect them more or less, right? That's an obligation we have, and if you want to withdraw from that, we have, you know, I think it's a little less than 30,000 troops there. If we want to, we can't just withdraw from that obligation wholesale without risk, not even counting the moral issue there. So we have to be careful of you know, overextension. And there's we're at odds. So a lot of the issues there with cutting have tended to be sort of local, right? So military expenditures are a fairly large job producer in various areas, and those areas are represented by you know, congresspeople and senators who don't want to cut those things.
Right.
And I think you've had situations recently where the military has actually come forward and said these are good cuts to make, and Congress has said no. So I think that's another issue we have to tackle. I'm not entirely sure, I guess, in answer to your question, that we can't do a lot of what we were wanting to do in terms of force projection and maintenance of order, not necessarily, you know, giant wars, but just maintenance of order and force projection, you know, even with a pretty pared-down military from what we have now, one can afford that.
Thank you so much, Professor Siegel, for being with us again. I appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Professor David Siegel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Florida State University. Thanks for your calls. I'm sorry it took most of the hour to get them on the air, but we got the problem fixed, so it won't be a problem again. That problem won't be a problem again. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda for on-air production. We have news coming up momentarily, and we'll continue with another hour of conversation as we go to space for the second hour. Tomorrow, our first hour is on healthcare and the money spent on healthcare, so it will be good for us to talk about that tomorrow.